Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Tom Dormer, our regular guest for Thursday mornings, is back with us today, and he is bringing with him his experiences and insight into the problems within the penal system and beyond. Serious issues within the country of mass incarceration, politics, media, racism, and resolutions. Tom has experienced both the good and the bad of both worlds, behind the prison walls and in the community. He uses his expertise to now be a voice for the incarcerated population around the country. I want to welcome Tom Dormer once again. Tom, are you on with us?
Yes, I am, Leon. How are you doing this morning?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm doing very well.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about what we were discussing last Thursday when you were on. You had a lot of information that you wanted to share with the regarding the coronavirus and a lot of the things that are going on in the prisons as well as outside.
Yeah, you know, I'm learning more information as the weeks are coming. Because Loke tuned in last week and kind of opened up some new light that's being shed there. But you know, some of the phone calls that they are granting for the two free phone calls a week, those count if you don't, you know, get connected to your family. And that's, you know, something that's not advertised, that people think, oh, just two free phone calls a week, but somebody calls their family, they don't pick up. It counts as one of them. And also the visitation, I found out more about the visitation as far as they're allowed one visit a month, you know, not per family member, not per person on their visitor list, but total. So, and it's a Zoom little Skype meeting, and it's 20 minutes, you know, and regular visits can accumulate to 8 hours a week. You know, when I was in prison and I was getting three visits a week, I was getting two during the week and one on the weekend, you know, two during the week are 3 hours, one on the weekend is 2 hours. And that's 8 hours maximum. You can see, you know, everybody on your visitor list, you know, 12 adults, you can see kids, if you have them on your visitor list, and more than 12 individuals. So the fact that you know, I would be really upset, and basically it's like you're in segregation during COVID. You know, it's like everybody is forgetting about you, and you're put down to a very low, you know, pedestal on the totem pole, because just imagine, you know, somebody that sees their family, somebody that, you know, their family gives them hope and their visitors give them hope, and it's something they look forward to, and it's helping them out in prison. And just imagine taking all that away. And I understand it's COVID, you know, it's a pandemic that nobody's really prepared for it at this level. But at the same time, we really can't say that one visit for 20 minutes a month, that you just basically can't see anybody on your visitor list then for months, if you do like two visits with your mom, and then you can't see anybody else. It's basically really inhumane, in my opinion, that people just can't visit their families. I don't understand how hard it would be to set up Zoom visits regularly. I think it would be an easier access for people, you know, instead of driving in these prisons that I've talked about many times, that they usually are in the country, they usually are away from civilization and usually away from the bigger cities. Bigger towns and the cities that the prisons are built in, and the state's prisons are built in. So I just don't, you know, that's one thing where I'm trying to come up with. I'm Googling things, and I'm trying to think a little bit more into it. Hopefully it changes by the end of 2020, because at least where I'm from in LA, it doesn't look like any type of rules, regulations, how the city is ran is going to change in all of 2020. Looks like, you know, for the rest of 2020, we're going to kind of have to adopt this COVID living lifestyle. So I'm just kind of shocked that nobody's really changed that yet, you know, in all of months. You know, COVID's been around for all of 2020, and you know, visiting rights have been kind of taken away for most of 2020. And I'm just surprised by now, you know, we're in July already, and you know, people can't see their family. They can't have, you know, they can't see the people on their visitor list, even if they wanted to. One visit, 20 minutes a week would definitely not be enough for somebody like me. So
I think what you're talking about, Tom, and you know, we just had a new director of media affairs join us, and in the organization, and I would love to have you to connect, because she is talking about the same thing you're talking about, and she's very motivated to get out there and start with the media. So if you can, perhaps we can talk after the show, but she's very much for getting all this out immediately, because she knows what's going on as well with the what's going on in the prison since the coronavirus. But the visits, as you say, the visits are very important. And there's a lot of families that they don't even know the situation of their loved ones. There's a lot of prisoners who are filing lawsuits, or not filing lawsuits, but contacting attorneys that already have lawsuits going on because of these things that are going on in the prison, since no one is overseeing anyone of officials or the employees, the guards. So this is something that really needs to be looked into.
You know, having outside support, it's kind of funny, because you know, you need outside support to be successful. I think anybody involved in the prison system just knows there's very, very few stories in the world of people that have been incarcerated for a period of time and don't have that support system and come out and really do something with their lives. We're not just talking about just not getting arrested or you know, working at McDonald's and just staying out of prison. We're talking about people that really accomplished something in their lives that maybe they wanted to do before prison. And I just think it's kind of insane that the prison system acknowledges this to such a high degree. They constantly acknowledge this in the prison system. When you go for your appeals, when you go to get, you know, less security staffing, when you go to get released, everything is about your support system. What do you have lined up? But all of a sudden now in prison, the support system, they're taking it away. They don't really worry too much about it. It's not too high on their priority list. And we just see over and over the COVID, you know, ratings go up in prison systems. You know, at least out in California they are. You know, in Wisconsin, they're fairly okay, but in California, you know, COVID, the people that are the prisoners that are being found positive for COVID are skyrocketing, and it's like, okay, so if security isn't a big issue, where COVID matters, if their support system, you're taking away that on top of that. What are you doing in COVID besides basically just making the correctional officers' jobs easier, just sticking everybody in cells? And basically when they get COVID, they go through a policy. And if they don't, they don't. That's kind of just what I see happening, is that people just, you know, okay, it's COVID and everything else in the world needs to be fixed, and we need to worry about so much else in the world. And everybody in prison is just, it's just forgotten about, just thrown in a box, thrown in a cell. They're being mistreated. How many thousands, literally thousands of African American young men throughout the prison system just this past week, do you think were sent to segregation? Do you think we're just mistreated and just thrown in a box? I'll tell you, thousands did. So, you know, I would like to change that and bring a little bit of light and awareness to those type of situations.
That would be awesome. These things need to be exposed. We're living in, I don't know if you had an opportunity to see the YouTube with the about the most humane prison in a country that has the most humane prisons in it. They talked about the prisons. I mean, the prisons were beautiful. And they had all the things in the prisons that they didn't even look like prisons, and they had their own rooms. It was more like a housing situation rather than prison with steel bars and everything. And the comparison between these countries and the prisons in the United States is just unbelievable. Their success rates are so good. the recidivism rates are so low, and here we have everything is just opposite. Everything is so militarized, and people are suffering inside the prisons and family members on the outside. And I know they committed their offenses, but they don't deserve to be treated the way they're being treated. And not being able to leave their cells for 23 hours, I mean, like you say, it's just not right. 2 free calls a week, and sometimes those calls are cut short.
Yes. One of my biggest things I had an issue with in my prison system, which is the state of Wisconsin, is they have something called a boot camp, an ERP program. Usually first-time offenders get it, younger offenders, and it's an alternative to get out of prison a little bit early. It's exactly what it sounds like, boot camp. You know, you're up every morning, you're working out. And every single individual that's ever been a part of that boot camp has always told me the same things. Is it's basically like the program I was in my medium with my AODA program. They basically just belittle you, and the ones to accept it are the ones to go home. The ones that are broken go home, but any of the ones that have the fight, that are like, no, you're not spitting in my face when you're screaming at me to do 20 push-ups, and you're treating me like a human being, you're not yelling at me, you're not just doing anything. There's discipline, and there's a way to show people how to get their lives together and alternatives, and there's that way. And, you know, I've always had an issue. I've never been able to experience it because I was denied by the judge. The judge did not want me to get out early. The judge wanted me to do all of my time. So, but everybody else I talked to, I've known a couple people that went through it. So it's just, you know, we could talk for days, and I'm just very blessed to finally have this opportunity. And I'm at a stage in my life where, like I said, I've been out 4 years, I've served 4 years, so I kind of have both little resumes on exactly the same time frames about being out and being in. And I just need to get to a certain little point in my life. I know I talk to people like you and other people where, you know, it's nice to be a voice, it's nice to be an advocate, but to make major changes, I'm close, and it's very nice to be at this stage in life. You know, I'm getting very more humbled every day. I'm taking everything more grateful, because I do remember I was out on bail before my sentencing for a whole year, and I was facing life in prison. I didn't understand why, but I was facing 130 years at one point, and I didn't know. I had to beg my community. I had to beg the judge for a whole year. I had to show everybody, you know, that my life should not be taken away and that my life has value. And, you know, that's not an easy thing to do, you know, at 18. At 18, you know, most 18-year-olds, they grow up, and they grow up the normal way. You know, 99% of America, you know, when you're 18 years old, most people go through the same things and the same stages in life mentally. And me, I had to look in the mirror. I had to look my community in the eyes. I had to, you know, not smile, not have fun. I had to be serious. I had to show people that my life was that had value, enough value to let me come out in society again. So I went through that part. I went through the 4 years where I was just amazed how this is actually how the system is run. And I realize why people come out and come back in 100%. And then now being out and, you know, interstate and compact, I am starting to separate myself. And, you know, all these years ago, I talked about it. I talked about coming out. I talked about having a goal. I talked about having a plan and executing the plan and, you know, doing it in the time frame I've done it. You know, things have taken me a little longer than I wanted to due to, you know, 5 major surgeries. But, you know, still after 5 major surgeries, I'm still at where I wanted it to be at. So I'm still grinding, but I now see myself starting to separate myself where hopefully I can open up some doors to show to make it easier for people, you know, because I had it easier than most people. I had a house to come out to. I had a job to come out to. I had a support system to come out to. I had people that just not only were my not my family, but they were, you know, specialists. I had people that reached out to me that were therapists. I had, you know, some doctors reached out to me to help me with my medical, you know, issues. I had people reached out to me to go to colleges. So I just want to do the same thing for other people, because I feel like it was such a, it gave me such an advantage over some of the other guys that were just getting released to the hood. And that was it.
Yeah.
They had to figure everything out. They had to go get a job. They had to go do everything themselves. And it sounds easy. People make it sound so easy. Oh, just go get a job. Go get a house. Stay out of trouble. Like, it's not black and white. It's not. It really is just not. And, you know, people's freedom when they get out of prison, they aren't free. They really, how can you call an individual free when they have somebody, at least one human being, a physical human being, that has so much power over their life? I mean, that's not free. You know, you would be maybe agreeing with me if you had the same thing. You know, somebody was watching over your life, and you know what, if they're having a bad day, or, you know, they're in a really wrong mindset, then your life, you know, your freedom is in jeopardy. And that's exactly what it is. So I want to do something in life where I can open up those doors, where I can just provide the same opportunities I was given when I got out. And I know those opportunities can propel people to success.
Yeah. Now, you're in college still. How much time do you have with what you're studying now?
Right now I have two semesters. I have a fall of 2020, so the end of this year, and then I have spring of next year. And spring of next year, I only need technically one class. So I'm almost done. And that's just for an AA in communication. But I'm going to use that AA to transfer. And like I said, I still want to play soccer, so soccer's still an option. But, you know, if I transfer, I want to transfer and get a bachelor's degree in kinesiology.
Yeah. So you're going to school for communication.
Yes,
which is awesome. That is awesome because that is exactly what's needed for exposures to, you know, to be involved with the media to bring awareness. And
yeah,
there's other,
like was...
other things.
I was just going to say, I feel like I always have a message to say. And when I got out, I just wanted a better way to learn how to deliver the message. I started public speaking right away, and I had some of my prison norms, and I had some aggression, and I had things like that. And I just wanted to communicate better. You know, I knew when I got out of prison, I knew I was somebody special. I just knew I did. Like I said, the world didn't see it yet, but I seen it. When the day I walked out of prison, I knew I felt accomplished. You know, and society brings you back down. They make somebody coming out of prison just feel so far behind, and, you know, everything you say, you're not as smart as the next person. You don't have as much knowledge as the next person. You have to live through it, and it's the total opposite. You know, when I got out of prison, I felt like I accomplished the hardest task I ever could in life. You know, I went from sitting in a box thinking about killing myself. I went from sitting in a box wanting to give up in life. I went from sitting in a box unmotivated to not only just walking out of prison, but walking out of prison with the statue I did. As being a white boy neutral, I was one of the most, you know, defined figures to walk in that prison system. Everybody knew me. I wasn't just an average Joe. I didn't just sit in my cell. I was out of my cell every single day. I was the first one up. I was the last one to go to bed. I set the tempo. I was at the rec facility every single day, never missed a day. I was a leader. I was somebody pushing a lot of hope and a lot of, you know, motivation throughout the prison system as young as I was. So I knew I was somebody special. I knew if I could do that in that type of an environment and that type of world with that amount of stress and negativity and hatred and everything surrounding me, I knew I could dominate in the real world. I knew I was prepared. I knew I was ready. I knew I had all the tools, but I also knew that I needed a period of time. I didn't know how long that time was, but I knew getting out of prison that I was different.
I knew I couldn't just, you know, flip a switch and, you know, just go walk right out in the community and nobody would know I was in prison. It's impossible, you know, and I'm not ashamed of who I am. So it's not like I was trying to hide or trying to be somebody else. No, I was just being myself. But I could tell every time I was myself, you know, when I walked in a room, everybody knew I was in the room the minute I walked in the room. So now that I had that statue and I had everybody's respect, I went to college. I wanted to go to college to learn how to articulate the conversations I wanted to articulate what I was trying to say to in the most efficient time so people could understand really, you know, what I'm trying to say.
Well, everybody can understand clearly what you're trying to say, and you have so much to say, and this has really been a blessing, as I say. A lot of times there's people talking, and they're not talking about anything. You're not getting the message. But in the situations you're talking about, suicides, I mean, you brought it up just now. You mentioned the word suicide, and there's been so many prisoners who have actually committed suicide. There's so many that have contemplated suicide. And coming out after being in a prison, you know, with bars, steel bars and cement walls and going through the various things that you have to go through when you're inside, I can see how difficult it is when you do come out. And then you come out only to have to deal with probations and have to deal with a previous record, you know, Corey and all these things. It doesn't help at all. It doesn't.
Yeah. You know, when I got out of prison, I kept saying, you know, I kept preaching about, you know, the hardships and how hard it is and all the rules. I was never on probation in my life, so all the rules and things like that. And when you get out of prison, like I said, everything you say, your intelligence, you know, it's all diminished to some type of degree. You know, people just want you to get out, and you need to be out for a certain period of time. And I remember when I got out, almost everything I said about, man, I can't get a job, and I've applied for so many jobs, and I started saving all the job applications. I started applying because they just started building up. And, you know, every time I mentioned something, you know, people just thought I was bitter. That's all it came across as, you know, in my community. You know, they, like I said, when you get out of prison, there is a lot of individuals that expect you to prove yourself again. And, you know, when you get out of prison, some communities, some of your neighbors, some of your people in your support system, it's like when you get out, it's like, okay, prove yourself you're worthy of being out here again. Now you not only had to prove yourself in prison and survive in prison, but you have to prove yourself out here. And anytime you get mad or upset, which are natural emotions, it's all of a sudden, you know, you have an anger issue because you went to prison, because you have a record, you have an anger issue. Or whenever you're like, you know, this is what's wrong with the system, or this is what's wrong with prison, is, well, you're bitter. You know, you're bitter from prison and you have a bias. But it's funny that over the years you're out, that narrative changes, you know, because your actions speak for yourself. And, you know, society and your support system, should it make somebody do that? You know, they've proven themselves. You know, I proved myself in prison. You know, I went in for 4 years. I went in as a kid. I looked at everybody. I owned up to all my poor choices. I the last thing I ever said in my court system to my entire family and to my entire community and everything, I said, I promise you that when I come out, I will be the man that, you know, I always knew I could be. And the day I walked out, I was that man. But that man was not good enough because that man had a record. And that man was only bitter at the system. And that man was not as knowledgeable as the next man that was as old as me, because that man had college credits, or that man had life. He lived life, and I didn't. I was in a box. So when I came out, I was just humbled. And everywhere I was around, I didn't really feel like I fit in again. I felt like I was the odd man out always. I felt like most 23-year-old adults in my life were still focusing on the bars, still focusing on women, still focusing on having fun. And I didn't know how to have fun. You know, I really didn't. When I came out and I tried to go to the bar, I was awkward. You know, even now, you know, somebody invites me to the bar, I'm awkward. You know, it's hard for me to – I've never been able to do that in my whole life. It's just turn off it. just turn off being aware, turn off being, you know, am I going to be safe, you know, because I have my whole life, you know, in front of my eyes. If I get in a fight, my whole life is taken away from me. I lose. If I get in an argument, you know, my whole life could be taken away from me. I lose. I always lose in any type of any stressful situation where the police are called or where there's high emotions riding on. I don't have those same luxuries. You know, I don't have the luxury to go to the bar with my friends and laugh and real laugh and really mean that I'm laughing and just you know, just taking the night off. I don't have those. So when I got out, I didn't want to have fun. You know, I felt like I was behind the eight ball. I felt like I was 5 years behind everybody, and I wanted to catch up. I wanted to work. I didn't want to work at a car wash. I didn't want to live in my parents' basement. I didn't want to have all of my community every time I walk around, oh, what are you doing? Oh, you're at a car wash. You're staying out of trouble. Good job. Good boy. Talk to me like I'm a little kid. I don't want that. I wanted to do everything that you want to do. You know, I want to go to college. Why can't I own a house? Why can't I be a CEO of a company? Why can't I do those things? And, you know, when I got out, that's how I felt. So I realized that, you know, people just naturally, when they hear you're in prison, there's two things, and you're out, there's just two things they want. There's number one, they want to know why you went to prison. Almost everybody does. When you mention you went to prison, no matter what, every individual wants to know why you're in there, because they think they can kind of know what type of human being you are, depending on your case or your choice that you made to go in there. And number two, they want to know how long you've been out. Your word just carries so different to the community, to everybody. You know, people would be lying. Even myself would be lying. We would be lying, and it sucks that prison has given us this narrative that you're hearing me talk. And if we were in a room and we had, you know, 20 people that were, you know, previously incarcerated, and 19 of them were out for years and, you know, have college degrees, some of them are business owners, and then we just had one guy that just got out the day before, most people, his words would mean less. You know, he wouldn't know as much as the other people. And I think that's a false narrative, because I've met a lot of people that are so intelligent, that have read books, that have, you know, they spend all day just learning and learning and learning and preparing for their opportunity. So somebody that's doing that every single day, and then when they get out, you just think, oh, you need to continue to do more to even speak to me, to even be on my level, is not right. And I just wanted to show people that. I kept trying to explain people. I kept trying to have conversations and, you know, open up those doors. And those doors always were shut to me. So people didn't want to talk about prison. Where I was from, people didn't want to have those conversations about the racial injustices, you know, and everything until now. You know, now these conversations, they can't be ignored. But, you know, just when I got out 4 years ago, they still didn't want to have those conversations. Prison was very not accepting. Prison was a very negative topic. It wasn't a bar topic. It wasn't a good topic. You know, talking about racial injustices wasn't a good topic. It was a hard conversation to have, you know, to have that with white people. Like, you know what, man, you know, because that's what I've said. I said, you know, if it's hard for me to make it out here, like, you know, what do you expect a black man from the ghetto to make it? You know, real. And then I've explained it many times. Like, I don't have to sit here and say, look at the internet to see the racial injustices. I can sit here and look somebody dead in their eyes and say, I've witnessed them. I've witnessed them.
Mm-hmm.
I've witnessed them. I've seen cases just like mine. As sad as it is, I've seen an 18-year-old kid that had a case, first case ever, by the way, 18 years old, and he walked in a bank with a note. Didn't have nothing on him. He just walked in a bank with a note, said he has a gun, going to rob the bank. He got the money. He didn't even have a gun. They arrested him. Gave him 10 years, you know, and he was a black kid. Of course, you know, had no support, gang banging. And they use that against him. You know, I was reading this case file, and one of the first things they say about this kid, gang banger. And I'm like, dude, he's 18 years old. He doesn't have a dad in his life. He's got no older brothers. And, like, you really think if you weren't in, most people were not in this dude's shoes, that he wouldn't veer towards older men that have structure, that are hanging out every day, you know, that's what boys need. They need role models. They need guidance. They need, you really think most 18-year-old men, black men, capable of just being like, you know what, I'm going to be a leader in my community. I'm going to go to school. I'm going to get straight A's and police themselves like that or hold themselves that accountable? No. You're going to want to go with people that are from your hood, that have something in common, same skin color, that are older, that, you know, you have protection, you have family. And it's like, yeah, 10 years, you know, 10 years to this kid, and he's smiling still. And he's like, you know what it is, I'm going to come out at 28. And I'm just looking at him like, they don't realize how special this human being is for somebody to look at 10 years and just say, you know what, that won't break me. I'm going to, you know, because it will break him. He just doesn't know it at that point. But to have that mentality where me trying to open up doors for other people, if you would have given me the same exact hand you've given this man in life, I would have folded that hand. I wouldn't have been able to accept that hand by society. I would have ended up passing up that hand, and we wouldn't be talking. So I've seen it, you know, going to prison. I've seen my best friends, you know, Franklin, that I talk to Franklin 3-4 times a week, every week since I've been out of prison for 4 years. I'm on his visitor list. I'm one of the first prisoners to get out and be on a visitor list a year after I got out. I demanded to be on a prisoner list. They denied me. I was thinking about getting a lawyer. I told my PO, and he was like, well, why is this so important to you? Like, why do you want to go back to prison? Like, why would you want to visit somebody? I said, that's because I want to. And they're like, well, we're not used to it because your PO has to sign off on it. And he's like, we're not used to somebody just getting out. And like, you need a year, but we usually normally don't let people go back to prison, let them visit on probation. And I said, I don't care. It's not a law. There's nothing in the law. There's nothing on Google. There's nothing. There's no reason why I should not be able to go visit somebody in there. And they couldn't give me a explanation besides that they didn't want to and it wasn't the normal. And that wasn't good enough for me. And if they couldn't give me some concrete evidence where it was in my rules, it was in the state of Wisconsin, it was in the DOC, it was in probation, felony probation, and it wasn't in either, then just saying I don't want you to isn't good enough for me, and I'm going to fight that. So they let me visit, you know, a couple guys in prison, which I'm very grateful for. And I've seen those guys. I've seen those guys literally be called monkeys by correctional officers. I've seen them be called names. And, you know, the minute they give any backlash, like, you know what, fuck you, or any little backlash, boom, thrown in a cage. I've seen my best friends get thrown in a cage and a correctional officer legitimately look at them and just say, what are you going to do? Like, knowing 100%, like, being that correctional officer, trying to put my feet into his shoes, really just looking at this human being saying, what are you going to do? Knowing, like, you're not going to do anything. It's not that big a deal. He doesn't think, like, dude's going to the hole for 30, 60, 90 days. He's got a 10-year bid. What's 3 months? They don't see anything wrong with it. And I've seen that time and time and time again where just black men in the state of Wisconsin in prison just get treated worse than any human being I've ever seen should. And yes, it's 2020, and yes, it's in the 2000s where, you know, they have cameras everywhere. But do you not think when they didn't have cameras maybe 30 years ago, 20 years ago, they weren't just treating black men in prison like slaves? Like, legitimately modern-day slaves, making them work for 13 cents an hour, then giving them tickets to take back that 13 cents an hour. People don't even realize they can make only $4.50 every 2 weeks. So that's $9, $10 a month, $9 a month. And do you realize that if you get in trouble or a correctional officer wants you, they can take back that $9? They can take away your wages and make you work for free, put you in segregation. You know how many inmates have been beaten, thrown into segregation? It's modern day slavery. And all this does is it revenues money. There's only a few things prison does by now. By now we have enough years, and I'm talking about years, plural, where we have enough evidence to realize what prison does is in certain states. Prison revenues money for that state. And I wonder where that revenue goes. So prison makes money, but we don't know where that money goes because the recidivism rates don't change. So prison not only makes money, but it continues the recidivism rate, the exact rate that it's always been, a very low rate. So most people, most 80-90% of people that ever walk into prison doors will walk in again. Most of that population is African American. Most of that population that are the prisoners go back to the same communities. It's insane that everything in the prison system hasn't changed. It hasn't changed. They've given a little bit, you know, it's changed over time as far as some programs and cameras and certain things, you know, voices speaking up for it. But as far as the recidivism rate, that's an easy just rate to look at online, and that's a falsified rate at that. You know, if you look at Wisconsin's recidivism rate, I've talked about it a few times. Wisconsin's recidivism rate on Google right now, if we all Google the recidivism rate in the state of Wisconsin, it's going to be like 35%. But that's only within 3 years. It's only within 3 years. Right now, technically, I have went towards the recidivism rate of not returning. So technically, I've let people know I've raised the recidivism rate, or I've dropped it a little bit. But what happens if I go back to prison tomorrow? I'm still under the recidivism rate that passed because I've been out for over 3 years. So it's a lie, because if they did the recidivism rate of just a lifetime, which they're supposed to, just basically recidivism means do you go back? It doesn't mean do you go back within 3 years, within 2 years. You know, I believe there's a state on East Coast that their recidivism rate is only 18 months. And then that's it. So no wonder it's so low, and it's still like 40%. Imagine if you increase that to 5 years, the recidivism rate would be 80%, and people would be like, okay, well, we really do need help. But the community doesn't know all of this, and it's a shameful that the recidivism rate for the United States, you can't even post up on Google. You can't get a real live. They won't give the country a real live recidivism rate. There's not one, not even in California. Every single recidivism rate is up to like 10 years. It's not a lifetime. And that's really what recidivism means. Recidivism means if you walk into prison and you are sentenced and serve prison time, when you walk out, whenever that is, do you ever walk back in? That's all it is. And that's what it should be. And there should be statistics that show that, and there are not. And I'm willing to bet, I'm willing to guarantee, actually, if there were real life statistics on Google, they would be in the 90% nationwide, everywhere in the United States, and everybody then couldn't do anything but agree, like, okay, maybe prison is not the way.
We have someone else on the caller. I wanted to say one quick thing. Is this low?
Yes, it is.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I wanted to respond to Tom, and then I'm going to let you two take over. The recidivism rate. You know, one of the things about this country, and I hate to say it, but everything about this country is lies and corruption. And the recidivism rate, the statistics, are going. Nothing's updated. I don't think they want it to be updated, because I don't think they want people to see just how corrupt this place is. The penal system. You mentioned, where does the funds go? When prisoners tell you, and the prisoners have told me, when they have to eat garbage from some other prisoners that has been ground up, that has been fed to them, and they're so hungry that they end up eating it because they don't have any other choice. And I'm saying, where does this money go? Because we have prisoners who are starving and will eat anything that they feed them, in spite of the fact that they know what they're feeding them is leftovers from other prisoners. That's one thing. Another thing is people expect remorse. Well, how do they determine what remorse is? Because some people are good at holding in their pain. A lot of people are in prison because of things that they have experienced or gone through prior to being incarcerated, and they're in so much pain, and they don't talk about it because they're not like other people in the communities that cry about every little thing that goes on in their lives. These are people that are incarcerated that have gone through some real hard times, and they haven't talked about it until one day, all of a sudden, they explode because they can't take any more. when I see people or hear people talking about they weren't remorse, and this happens a lot in the media or in the courts, that, you know, he didn't show any remorse, even with the parole board. He didn't show any remorse. Exactly what do they look for to determine if a person is remorseful or not? Those are things that I'd like to have you two talk about as well.
Well, I'm going to, number one, I'm going to let Lope talk a little bit just because he joined, and he joined a little bit late in the conversation, so I'm going to bring him up to speed really quick, and then I'm going to let him take over, and then I'll join back in. But, you know, Lope, you can 100% talk about this, you know, with going, you know, to jury and going to everything about, you know, what they said about your case and being remorseful and everything. The only thing I have to say about this, back about my case, is you can't win. You can't win. It's a non-winnable situation when you're getting sentenced or when you're doing something and you say sorry, because every time you say sorry, the judge says you're only saying sorry because you were caught, or you're only saying sorry to get out of trouble. And every time you don't say sorry, the judge looks at you and says, how can you not say sorry? You're an animal. So it was kind of the same case situation for me, is I did say I was sorry, and the judge didn't really know. The judge was like, well, I think you're saying sorry because you got caught, my victim was saying, but they had 11 and a half months of a resume of me being out on bail. So I 100% agree with that. They had my whole life looked at, where I've never been in trouble, where I proved I was sorry. I didn't prove I was sorry just because I got caught. So that's a good topic, because even on YouTube now, I told you one of my hobbies on YouTube now is to, I always look up sentencing. I don't understand why. I don't know why it affects me so much, but I look up people getting life in prison and their sentencing reactions and how the judges handle the cases and in different cases. And every single one, 100%, when the person is getting sentenced, it's the same thing. You know, you guys got to YouTube sentencing and watch it, and watch when they say sorry. The judge only has two reactions. They have, you're only saying sorry because you were caught and you don't want to go to prison, or if you choose not to say sorry, they're an animal, and they don't know how you can stand up there and not say sorry. So I don't know how you can win. But Loke's definitely had a worse hand. You know, in life, you just meet people that you just realize. I don't know how to explain it, but, you know, at one point in my life, in my city, I only knew my city. I only knew my community. I only knew the people in my community. I only knew my school. Those were all norms for me. I wasn't a black kid from the hood. I didn't have those norms. And I had different norms. I had a different lifestyle. And when I went to prison, I felt sorry for myself. You know, I did. I was the only one in my whole age group. I was the only one in my whole community going through what I was going through. And I really felt like I was given the worst hand ever in my whole city. You know, everybody in my age group, I was like, damn, like, this sucks to really realize. Like, I was given the worst hand out of everybody. And then you meet people where no matter what, they just open up to you. They just have conversations with you. And as a human being, you can look at another human being. Like, we're talking to one right now. He's just one of many where I looked at, and I just, from the minute they speak, you're just taken back, because you hear and you see another human being which deserves as much as I do, just given such a different hand in life, where it makes you think for a second, like, I don't know what I would do with that hand. Where I'm talking about now, I have so much confidence, and this is what I'm going to do. That would all change if I was given a different hand, like the man we're talking to now, and, you know, a couple of men that have paved the way for me. So, but yeah, Loke, you can talk about it and take it over for a couple of minutes.
Well, like you said, you kind of made a point where, with regards to remorse, it is kind of a double-edged sword, I guess, because, I mean, they said the same thing when the judge was sentencing me. He said the same thing to me, you showed no remorse. Well, it's kind of hard for you to show remorse if you're saying that you're innocent of committing the crime. If you're saying, hey, I didn't do this crime, I didn't commit this crime, I'm innocent, how can you expect me to show any remorse during the sentencing phase? If during this whole trial I was saying, hey, it's not me, I didn't do it. There are people that do just say that they're sorry just because it seems like the right thing to say, or it's the politically correct thing to say, or in hopes of getting a lighter sentence. And I believe that there are some who are genuinely sorry for the crimes that they committed, for the, you know, the act that they did. So it's kind of difficult with regards to remorse, because I'm sure some people are remorseful for what they did. They regret what they did at the time. Some people commit crimes off impulse. You know, it's not that they're bad people. It's not that they had bad intentions. It's just you never know the reason why a person may commit any given crime. Now, a person touching on a child or a grown adult that's in their right state of mind, that doesn't have any mental issues or anything like that, and they touch on a child or molest a child, or you can't turn around and say you're sorry for that, because you knew better. You knew damn well what you were doing. So, you know, with regards to remorse, it depends on the circumstances, you know. But, again, it is difficult if you did commit a crime, like if you did a robbery or you broke into someone's house or you stole their property or something like that, or even if you did bodily harm to someone and, you know, you are genuinely sorry for what you did, sometimes the judge may not believe you. And, you know, so how do you, how do you deal with that type of situation? They have now what they call compass tests, where they give you a bunch of questions. They give you a bunch of questions, and they score you based on your answers. And so that determines the level of programming you need, the chances of you coming back to prison. Does this person show empathy? Does this person show empathy or have empathy? So now they do certain tests where they ask you a list of questions to determine if you need an anger management program or a substance abuse program, or what are your chances or percentage of you reoffending if you were to be released into the community. Does this person have empathy? So, I mean, these tests are pretty, the questions are pretty, I don't know. I mean, the questions are pretty simple. So I don't know. You know, again, they just come up with all these different tests and theories of what they think determines a person's mind state at that time or even currently. You can't ask a person a certain amount of questions to determine if they will reoffend or their chances of reoffending, or does this person have empathy, because if this person has been incarcerated for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, they may not be the same person that they were 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 15 years ago. You know, but under, again, Wisconsin's truth in sentence law, you don't get to, no matter how many programs you take, no matter how many achievements you have, I mean, regardless of the fact, you still have to do your time, all your time. So it doesn't even matter if you have good behavior, if you completed certain programs. Your mandatory release is still going to be your mandatory release. You don't get any parole. So, you know, some say there's no benefit of, you know, behaving or taking certain programs. If, you know, if there's no reward in it, you know.
Hey, I'm very glad that – I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I think just like with the children in school, they're so anxious to get these kids back in school. You know, it's ridiculous, because they're putting the kids at risk to get them in school. But everything is based on education. Nothing's based on humanity. Nothing's based on talking to individuals and learning about them. You know, you put down things on paper. One of the things is, a lot of times people communicate in this day and age through emails and texting, and not being able to talk to one another one-on-one in, you know, on the phone or something. People misunderstand, because you can text me something and I can take it a different way than I would take it if we're on the phone talking or in person. And this is the way it's gotten to be in the country, is that everybody's texting. People are going off on one another. test in prison, coming out, parole, everything is based on paper, and everything is based on tests. Nothing is based on, well, let us have a conversation with this person. Let's see what they've done while they were incarcerated. You know, maybe they didn't have an opportunity to take education because they were denied or deprived. You know, these things, they have to look into these things too. Ask the person, well, why didn't you get your GED? Or why didn't you take correspondence courses? Why didn't you do this? Let the person tell them, I tried. And if you look at the lawsuits that I filed, or if you look at the grievances I filed, you'll see that I tried. But they don't do it. Everybody's so busy looking at paperwork that they're forgetting about the inside of a being. They're forgetting about what could have taken place to prevent that person to be productive while incarcerated. So if they would get rid of this paperwork and they would stop thinking that they are so intelligent, these people that create all this paperwork, these people that think that they're smart, smarter than those in the prisons, and they don't like it when they find out that there are people in prison that are much smarter than them. It makes it even more detrimental that they keep that person incarcerated or they keep them down.
Tom made a point earlier where he said that there's nothing being done in the correction system, and I have to agree with him 100%. There is nothing being done to correct the system of corrections. You have the higher ups, the people that sit behind their desk, and for a lot of issues or things that may come across their desk, all they do is rubber stamp it, denied, or you know, they give some excuse as to why this shouldn't change or why this is a certain way. There's nothing being done as a whole to, even in the legislature, there's nothing being done to correct the correction system.
No.
The correction system is not functioning the way it's intended to be functioned. Again, you know, throughout history, you know, any prison institution and jails is supposed to be one part punishment and the other part rehabilitation. The rehabilitation part is only functioning as a way of receiving, continue to receive the government funding, the federal funding that these programs receive. That's it. Besides that, it's not about rehabilitation.
No. You know, since this pandemic, prisoners have been kept in their cells 23 hours a day, some of them without their televisions, some without their books. A politician called over to a prison, and this is Susan Baranowski, once again in Massachusetts, to talk to them about returning the prisoner's books and return, you know, trying to give him his TV. This is how the prison does things. They say that this prisoner got rid of his own legal material because he no longer wished to keep it. And his books, he has books in his possession, which is a lie. So these are the things that have been going on. People in these prisons that oversee, either guards or officials, they will lie their teeth off. And nobody can tell if they're lying or not because there's no oversight. Prisoners will file lawsuits because no one's fighting for them, so they're fighting lawsuits on their own. Most of the time they're denied or they're prevented from following through with their lawsuits. One prisoner filed a lawsuit. They put that prisoner in the hole about 6-7 months later, put that prisoner in the hole and filed a motion with the court to have the case dismissed. Once the case was dismissed, they let the prisoner out of the hole. These are the kind of things that go on in the prisons. Right, the prisons are not doing anything for anybody, and that's why I am fully in support of defunding the Department of Corrections and around the country, and also defunding law enforcement. They can put that money into long-term residential treatment programs where there's going to be all kinds of support and all kinds of services put in place so that when these people go into prison, which is not going to be a prison, it's going to be a treatment facility, whether it be for 5 years or 10 years, they're going to come out whole, not broken. And in the penal system, that's what they do. Prisoners go in with psychological problems or with addictions or with anger, and they come out 10 times worse. they're not getting the treatment that they need. They're getting the abuses, they're getting the deprivations, they're getting the harassments and provocations and everything else, but they're not getting the treatment. So taxpayers are throwing their money out the window when they keep funding these people, when they keep funding these facilities. They're throwing their money away when they could be putting it into something that's going to be successful, keep their community safe, keep these prisoners whole. That's the mentality of America. They don't know what they're doing. Everything is paperwork. Everything is office. Everything is sitting on your butt with your uniforms on, acting like you're doing something when you're not doing anything. People are throwing their money out the window in this country.
Especially in the state of Wisconsin. If I'm not mistaken, don't quote me on this, but I think in the state of Wisconsin there are 31 adult prison institutions. 31.
Yeah, look, Wisconsin has, right now, I looked up, Wisconsin has the second highest incarceration rate per capita in the whole United States.
Yes.
So they're number two.
Yes.
And then with the recidivism rate, they're top five, and they are one of only, I believe, two or three, I'm not Googling it, but one of two or three states with truth in sentencing. So out of the whole United States, Wisconsin's a very very red alerting state as far as the system, everything about it, not just going to prison, the recidivism rate, the prison law with truth in sentencing, with everything, you know. California runs it completely different with the three strike rule, and that's a conversation for another time, but there are three, you know, there's different, there's just in the whole United States in different states right now, you know, right now in the state of California, this is a fact. Because of COVID, that if your PO comes over to your house and you're doing heroin right in front of them, you know you're not going back to jail. You're doing a treatment plan. You're getting help in the programs and you're doing everything because they just can't send people back to jail for that anymore because the jails are so populated and you know it's filled with coronavirus. Where in the state of Wisconsin, Loke and I both know within a second if we said, hey, you know, what were you doing if you opened up the door and you had, an ounce of weed on your table and you were just smoking weed in your living room, you know, having a full-time job, staying out of trouble, you would be getting arrested if your PO came over and that was the case. So I just think it's very hard. And the one thing I wanted to say is I know it was my white privilege before I went to prison. I didn't really notice it, you know, with all these conversations happening now and all these lights being, shined on. And plus, like I said, I'm going in for my communication degree, and my communication degree, a lot of it talks about racial injustices and things like that, and white privilege. You know, it's like an invisible knapsack you wear on the back. They call it the lady that wrote the book about white privilege in canyons, and I believe I didn't notice it 100% because I was given – I do have a unique story. I was given a chance in life, and I believe in most cases, if most people were given the chance I was, the court system could really see who they were. People don't understand when I got sentenced – when I got – not sentenced. When I got arrested and I went to my first bail hearing, my bail was $100,000. It got dropped down to $75,000. My family clearly didn't have $75,000. They weren't doing the 10%. They needed it all. So I had an option. My lawyer looked me dead in the eye. He looked my family dead in the eye. He said, listen, the DA is offering 10 years. If Tom stays in there, he's going to get a lot of time. There's no doubt about it, but maybe I can offer him 7 years, 8 years. But Tom's getting almost a decade. With probation, he's getting over a decade. There's no doubt about it. He says if he gets out, if he bails out, he could do one of two things. He could get less time or he could get almost life in prison because he's going to be out on bail about a year. And if he's out on bail on a year, if he messes up one time, if he's caught with a gun, if he's caught doing drugs, if he's caught on a dirty UA, if he's caught anything where he gets revoked for this bail for 11 months, that 10 years, it's going to double at least. So, my lawyer talked to me and he says, you know, he didn't really know who I was. And he was like, listen, I got to tell you, getting out of prison, it's a big risk, but you're basically betting your life. Do you want to bet? He asked me the day I got out. He said, do you want to bet your life? Do you want to bet on it? And I said, yeah. And my grandma was right there and my grandma looked at him and she said, we'll put up our houses. She had two houses. She said, we'll put them both up for him right now. And he says, just so you know, if Tom gets in trouble, and he ends up going back to jail in 11 and a half months, you guys are homeless, and he's going to do 20 years in prison. And my family said, you know, my grandma said at the time, she looked me dead in the eye. She said, are you going to mess up? I said, no. She said, you're going to show everybody who you are? I said, yes. And she said, okay, let's show them. And I came out, and I was just blessed enough to have the team that I had. I had, you know, the team, the lawyer that I had all of his, you know, members working on my case. I had my own PSI investigation. I had my own therapist. I had my own psychiatrist to look at everything. I had my own volunteer organizations. I had my churches. I had my school. So I think if most people were given that opportunity to show their remorse, they would. And I did. You know, I showed my remorse. I came out. I bet on my life. And when the day I walked out, the DA even looked at me and he says, you know, if you want to walk back in, I'll give you 10 years. I won't argue. But if you don't, I'm going to ask for more. And I said, I want to fight it. So, you know, being out on bail, it sounds easy. But imagine being an 18-year-old kid out on bail, facing 130 years, having the state of Wisconsin, the guy representing the case, going after your life, looking you in the eye and telling you, you're not getting a decade. You're getting more than that. I'm coming after your life. I want to throw it in a box. So it was a lot of pressure. It was a lot of stress. But I knew I was capable. I knew I was built for greatness. And I came out. I showed everybody, you know, who the real me was. I had the PSI. And long story short, when I was going to get sentenced, even the state PSI, my PSI recommended probation, clearly. But the state PSI, she was doing this over 35 years, and I was one of her last cases she was ever doing. She was retiring. I was one of her last cases doing it. She went on record saying she has never met anybody like me. Out of 35 years, out of everybody that she has done a PSI for the state of Wisconsin and Waukesha and Milwaukee counties, she said that she's like, I've never seen anybody like him. She's like, his case doesn't add up. All the years in prison doesn't add up. She 100% says if you send him to prison for a long time, he's not going to make it, you know. So she's like, you know, you're basically taking away his life, and I believe that this one's special. I don't know why he got in trouble 100%, why he did that. He gave up in life, but she says if you give him another shot, I promise you, I really think he'll take it. And even the DA at that point, the DA agreed. Everybody kind of agreed. And the judge, the long story short, I know I said that, but why I'm trying to explain this, and I'm glad that Loke brought up the test that he brought up, and you know, the little questionnaire that you do when you get out to see if you'll reoffend or everything, is when I took that questionnaire in prison, I scored extremely low on all the categories. On every single category, I was extremely low about coming back, about returning to prison. But yet again, my social worker, when she has to give her point of view or her you know, her judgment call, her opinion, she wrote on there saying that I was a high risk because you know, I got in trouble. I got major tickets. I was in minimum, and I broke the rules, and I had an iPod, and I had things like that. So I was just a horrible person breaking the rules, and I was somebody that I was not. So that test is, you know, it's a simple questionnaire. It's something that they give everybody when they get out of prison. I don't really think it's 100% necessity, but I was glad that by the time I got out, I had a different judge on my case. And my judge was not letting me get any of the ERP, any of the boot camp. My judge was pretty difficult on me about not letting me out early. She thought that 4 years was a break and that she was not going to give up on that 4 years. When I got out and I applied to get out for my 85%, I had an older judge. He was a really old white dude, and he was known for being hard and for being lenient at the same time. And I had 6 major tickets within the last year. I was in segregation just a couple months before I applied for this. And everybody I ever talked to was like, man, Pitt, you ain't going to get this. Why would you even apply for your 85%? And I looked at him. I'm like, man, if you think that just getting some tickets in prison and just getting in minor trouble in prison, like if you don't think that the rest of my record and my whole life shows I'm a good person, then you're not really looking into my case at all. And I was like, I got to know, do they really look into your case? And thankfully, the judge wrote me back saying he didn't care anything that happened in prison. He was a really good human being. He said, listen, I don't care about the tickets. I don't care about the little questionnaire you did. He says, I tell you, you have a chance. And he's like, I'm going to give you a chance. I think you deserve to get out of prison. I think that I didn't even look at your prison record. He wrote in the letter, he said, I didn't even look at your prison conduct. I didn't look at any of the things you accomplished. I didn't look at you going to school. I didn't look at all the certificates you had. He said, I didn't care. I cared about your message and what you wanted to do when you got out.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying about people. It's the inner heart. You know, you got two different individuals giving you two different answers, and one of them was so-called righteous, and the other one was humble. This is the difference in the way people are treated. This is the way.
I was just amazed that my social worker, you know, because I had a very unique case, and Loke seen my. Loke seen this happen. This is the very thing I'm talking about now. He's seen it happen in person. He was the guy waiting on. He wasn't on my unit. You know, my closest friend on the unit was GI and Al, and Al seen this. You know, and that's Loke's, you know, very good friend for many years. And you know, Al seen this. Al seen me blowing up. You know, the social worker at the prison, you know, Loke is at. She put a recommendation saying I was a high risk, that I was returning to prison, that I was, you know, not the person that I was portraying for the last 5-6 years of my life, and kind of just somebody unqualified to even give that statement, but yet again giving that statement. And when the judge wrote us back saying, release him, do you know I told you that it gives the social worker 21 days to release you? The social worker, not even the state of Wisconsin. She has nothing to do with anything besides she's paid by the government. She's a social worker in a prison. It is actually up to her to release you right then and there. She's got 21 days. That's three whole weeks of my life where she was going to make me wait. And I was not having that. And I literally sat in the day room. And when they told us to go back to our bunks and sleep, I didn't. I stayed in the day room. I stayed in the thing, and I said, I don't care. You guys are going to have to put me in segregation. I'm writing my lawyer. My grandma called up there like 10 times a day. I had my people called. I had each individual person. I said, if you really love me, you're going to call up here, and you're going to call up here every freaking 10 minutes. Every hour you're going to call up here, and you're going to leave messages and messages and messages. You're going to call the newspapers. You're going to call the news stations. You're going to write letters to the warden. If you care about me, I want to go home. I deserve to go home. I ain't having this lady tell me I'm here for 3 weeks. And the day she told me that, she told me to get out of her office. And they called the captain on me, and they went to put me in segregation. And the captain right away came in, and Al remembers this. He says, you must be Mr. Dormer. First thing, he didn't even know me. He walked right in. He said, you must be Mr. Dormer. I said, yeah, I want to go home. What the hell is wrong with your social worker telling me that I'm waiting 3 weeks? I got my family on the phone right now. Like, I'm not hanging up. I'm not going to bed. Put me in segregation or whatever. I said, this is injustice, what you guys are doing to me. I just got a letter by the judge that I'm holding by the state of Wisconsin telling me to release me as soon as possible. And I got your old white lady social worker that's super unqualified, that doesn't even know me, on a different unit. She was on a different unit telling me I can't go home. That's not sitting well with me. So thankfully, the next day, they didn't put me in segregation. The next day, the captain, right at 8 in the morning, met me and walked right over to the social worker and went in there with me. She was super surprised, and he said, listen, you need to do the paperwork. He's got everything. He's got his family. He's got everybody waiting. You need to do the paperwork. You need to get him home. You need to get him home this Tuesday. And it was on a Friday, and he says, you need to get this paperwork done by the end of the day so we can go home on Tuesday. She looked at me. She didn't say anything. And that's when she asked me, okay, well, what are you going to do when you get home? What type of job? I started showing her 5 jobs, and she just hated on me. I don't know why, but she just was looking at me like, do you really think you're going to be a pro soccer player? Do you really think you're going to be able to go to California? She's like, do you really think that you have a 40-hour job the minute you walk out and you have a place to live? Like, okay, well, do you have a second place to live? And I was like, yep. Do you have a third place to live? I was like, yep. Do you have a fourth? I literally had on paper, the day I walked into the social worker getting out of prison, I had 44 residents in a row, 1 through 44. I said, listen, lady, you can pick 1 through 44. Doesn't matter the number. Here's a piece of paper. Here's a signature. Here's a little letter explaining that I'll follow the rules and I'll go home. I have 44 houses in the state of Wisconsin, different counties, all in Waukesha County, but in different parts of the city. Whatever one you want to choose to, I don't care. I just want to go home Tuesday. That's all I care about. And she hated me. It was very sad to see that somebody like me, even though I am me, and it's hard talking about my own self, but that I did. I was different. I think Loaf knows
and she
that.
Hated you.
Yeah.
She hated you even more. She hated you even more because someone showed her up. Someone showed her up. That's the difference between good and evil. You know, the good person, the good spirit showed the evil spirit up, and she didn't like you because somebody stood by you. Somebody supported you in your efforts.
And you know,
you embarrassed her. That's what it is, and that's not humble. That's not humility on her part. That's pride, and her pride got hurt. So she hated you because somebody supported you.
And Loke played a big role with me going home. The last thing I'll say, Loke, only 30 seconds, and I'm going to let you take over, is because Loke lived this with me. You know, it's nice finally having somebody on the phone that lived this with me. He really did live that time with me, and he's seen me go crazy. He remembers me coming out in the yard just like starting to lose it, like, and he was like, listen, you know, you got to call him. He was the one that was my mentor at this time and kind of told me, like, this is what you need your family to do, and gave me kind of the blueprint to go home. But he seen it firsthand where I was just totally shocked, and I was totally in disarray.
Yeah, I was drawn to Tom instantly. I mean, I guess he had heard about me and he had introduced himself to me, and you know, he had been seeing me around on the compound or whatever, because you know, as you mentioned, you know, before that, I used to run a little cardio group, and at the time I was also working in the barbershop. So, you know, he approached me and we talked, we had a conversation. You know, he let me know, like, look, he's going to be coming to the barbershop, you know, could I cut his hair? And from that point on, it was just like we was almost inseparable, you know. And just to kind of piggyback off what you were just saying as far as the social workers and stuff like that, I can attest to that also, that, yes, there are some of these social workers or staff members that work in these prisons that are kind of jealous of, you know, inmates, guys in here that have a lot of good family support. And, you know, it's kind of surprising to them when they see that everybody likes you. You're a very likable person, and all these people gravitate towards you, and it kind of, I don't know, it kind of messes with their head, I guess, a little bit, because, again, they're only looking at you, or they're judging you based off what they see on paper, but they haven't really sat down and had actual conversations with you. They haven't interacted with you. So in the back of their mind, for one, you know, they get to see how many visits you get and, you know, all the type of different support you have, and they can check and see who sends you money and how often or whatever. And, you know, again, then they see all these inmates and some of the staff that may, you know, speak to you and have, you know, interact with you and see how people, just everybody in general, treats you. And it kind of, I think it messes with their head a little bit, like, well, damn, what is it about this guy? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, a lot of times, and Tom, people, those that relate to you right away, those people have the same, in a way, they have the same heart, the same inner spirit, and that's why they can relate to you. The respect that's shown between, you know, like law enforcement, they call themselves brothers. You know, you call whatever the area that you are, your brothers or sisters or whatever, the brotherhood. And that's where a lot of times when certain prisoners are able to relate to other prisoners in a positive way, it's because that's the brotherhood in that area. You have good and bad wherever you go. People, they hear the word prison, and all of a sudden everybody stereotypes, oh, my gosh, they're all criminals. What they don't realize is there are people in prison who have more of a heart than a lot of people on the outside. There's people in prisons that are more educated than a lot of people on the outside. There's people in prison that have lived their education with their life experiences.
Mhm. Yeah, Tom, I can attest to this personally. Tom is a stand-up guy. Like you said, he's been out of prison 4 years. And the man has remained in contact with me throughout the whole 4 years that he's been home. If he doesn't hear from me in a couple of weeks, he'll text or call my mom and say, hey, you know, how's Loke doing? Is he okay? Tell him to give me a call. If I don't call Tom in 2 or 3 weeks, if he doesn't hear from me, he's going to make sure that I'm okay. You know, he doesn't want to assume that anything is wrong, and he'll call my mom. But again, just again, another show of his character, what type of person he is, you know? And it just, I mean, I love him like a brother. You know what I mean? I even recall meeting his mom and dad on a visit and some of his family on a visit. We were on a visit. And, you know, he introduced me to his mom and his dad and some of his family members. So, you know, we talk about brotherhood and friendship, camaraderie and things of that nature, you know. Yeah, we have that.
And it's,
you know,
it always means a lot.
It helps.
Me, you know, because you can go, Leona, really quick.
No, I was just going to say the families, a lot of times families, you can tell a person by the family involvement too, you know. And in your case, Tom, you mentioned so many times that, you know, you had your family behind you 100%.
Yeah, I was super blessed, and my whole life I related to sports, every aspect of my life in sports, and some people related to other things, but sports are a huge part of my life. And before prison, they were, you know, I was captain on the soccer team. I was a soccer stud, and you know, whenever you're a part of the team, that's what you live for. You know, my life growing up, I had a girlfriend when I was 16, but up until I was like 16 years old, and that was when I was late in my 16, I was almost 17 at that point. Up until I was 16 years old in my life, I never talked to a single girl. You know, I never partied. I never was into girls. I was never anything like that. My life was every day. It was soccer. It was my friends. It was that camaraderie, which you mentioned. Like, I was all about the team. You know, in soccer is not very individualistic. Where in basketball, you know, you have a LeBron James. You know what? You're going to the playoffs at least. You know, he can carry you to the playoffs, and you need other guys to step up when the time comes. But in soccer, you need everybody. You need your goalie, you need your defense, you need your forwards, you need all 11 guys, and then you need the bench. You know, soccer, you're running 8-9 miles within an hour and a half chasing a ball. You know, you need guys to come in and give you energy, and so you need a whole team. And there's nothing like in sports training all week of running 20, 30 miles, you know, before the game and sweating and blood and pain, and then playing the game with your brothers, and then you win. You know, there's not a greater feeling beside after that game when you're just sitting down drenched, but you feel accomplished. You accomplish something with your brothers. And I've always been a part of a team my whole life. I've been a part of a team. I've been on the team aspect of it. And I understand it takes a team to get to the ultimate goal. And when I went to prison, I was blessed. One of my first stories I mentioned about prison is, and Loke, I've told this story about Loke a couple of times, but when I was in Dodge, I was in a maximum security prison. I was waiting to get sentenced, and on my sentencing, usually they give you, I was talking about it, usually they give you two or three prisons on your staff, because the days you move, it helps people not get, you know, breaking out of an escape. You know, if you're just staffed to one prison and they know, hey, every Wednesday they go to this prison, you might be able to have somebody wait outside the prison and break you out. So you're usually staffed to a couple prisons for security reasons. Well, when I was staffed to KM, it was a medium prison. I was also staffed to Dodge, which was a maximum prison, because I got a couple tickets early on. I broke a phone. I didn't know. I was a little young kid. I was mad. I broke a phone. And I went to the hole for telling the CO off and stuff. You know, just a little angry. So they wanted to maybe keep me in max prison because they didn't know. And long story short, when I was sitting there, I went to the basketball court. One of the first days I was ever able to go to rec, ever in my whole prison bit. So I go to basketball court, and I'm the first one there. And I grab the basketball, and within 10 seconds I had a younger black, you know, male come up to me and say, hey, let me see that ball real quick. And I grabbed it, and then they're like, hey, we got our 10. And I was just looking at them, and I was like, well, you know, I wasn't used to it. You know, I was always playing basketball, and they're like, hey, we got our 10. You know, you're not playing this game. And so, you know, they're trying to bully me, and I didn't really know what to do at the time. I'm like, all right, well, I'm playing next. And they're like, all right, you got next. But we already had our 10, and, you know, this is what we do. And I was like, all right, I got winter. Well, when winter came around, there was another group of five that had their next over me, and they were all black. I was the only white dude on the court, and no white dude was trying to play basketball. So I went up to the and I grabbed the ball, and everybody looked at me. They're like, hey, man, give us the ball back before you get hurt. And I looked at them and I was like, man, you guys are all acting like a bunch of bitches. And I didn't know the term at the time. I never realized in my life how disrespectful the term bitch was in prison. It's a no-go. You know, basically, if you call somebody that word, you better be prepared within the next couple of seconds to fight, because somebody's going to fight you. And they all looked, the whole gym kind of stopped. Everybody even lifted weights kind of stopped. The people walking the track, the volleyball, it was pretty loud. Even the CEO got up. Everybody kind of froze and looked at me. And, like, the whole 10 guys were like, hold up, what did you just all say to us? And thankfully, I had this guy named Champagne. He was an older black dude. He was a swamper on the unit. He was very well respected. He came running out on the basketball court. He grabbed me and he was like, hey, guys, like, he just got sentenced. Like, he doesn't know. And they were all like, oh, hell no, you better get this guy or we're going to kill him. You know, you better get him. Like, what's this dude's attitude? And so it was kind of funny because he came and he kind of like picked me up and he's like, listen, you got to let go of this basketball. You got to walk with me right now or you ain't going to make it, kid. Just walk with me. So I've just been blessed in my life many times. That's just one time instant where I've always had an older brother. I've always had a mentor in prison. And I realize that every day I'm out here because I really wouldn't be able to talk the game I talk, or I wouldn't really be able to be in California. I'm very blessed. And sometimes it's just natural as a human being to not wake up every day and feel so humbled, and to wake up and, you know what, I got to go to work. I got to take care of my kids. I got to pay my bills. I got to do this. And they kind of just get wrapped up in life. And, you know, they forget about all the little things that add up. And, you know, I don't. I wake up every day, and like every day I see my car, I see my palm trees, I see the house I have, I see my dogs, and I realize, like, man, you know, like, I really had to fight for my life one day. Like, one day, you know, like there was a time in my life, you know, just 8 years ago on, you know, this time, 8 years ago, I was fighting for my life to get a second chance. And then, you know, for 4 years, I was fighting to get out of prison, and now I'm here, and I can never look at myself in the mirror and say I got here by myself. I can't. Like, every day I have a picture of Loke right now that I'm looking at. I have a picture of Franklin. I have a picture of Poovy, RIP. I have a picture of all these putter that played pivotal roles, where it's like, I really do walk around every day knowing, like, damn, I'm here because of these people. Like, it did take a team. It took my support system. It took my visits. It took my job opportunities when I got out. It took my support system in and out of prison. And even Loke played a pivotal role up until the end when I did get my 85%. He was the first dude to tell me, like, hey, I think you should stop playing soccer. And I went out there, and some kid grabbed the ball, and, you know, it was a young black kid, and we were going to get into it, and I wasn't thinking straight. Loke and Al were the first two people right there on the soccer field. Like, you know what, hey. And I stopped playing soccer. They looked right at me. They're like, listen, man, people are know you're going home. They're gonna try to test you right now. They're going home. You know, you have everything to lose, not them. Do you want to go home or do you want to play prison soccer? Which one do you want to do? And I was like, I want to go home. And they're like, all right.
I remember that too.
Come over by us. The minute I got in an argument, the minute, like, something aroused, I just got my 85%. That day I was feeling good. The word got out. I got my 85%. And all of a sudden I got tested. Some guy tried to grab the ball from us. We got into it. He's like, all right, on rec next time. He's like, you know, I think he was a young GD or something. And he's like, all right, on rec next time, me and my boys got you. And we just started getting into it. And I was like, fuck it, let's do it right now. And then all of a sudden, before anything could happen, I turn around and Loke was right there. Al was right there with a couple of my mentors. Like, listen. And they pulled me back, and literally next week I went home.
I was telling you, I'm like, man, there's no room for error now. We don't need you getting into any type of confrontations or anything like that. It's time to go home, man. Remember that.
I just remember what he was telling me, and I could really see it in his face. And like I said, you know, you get humbled by people like Loke and by people in your life that are supposed to do that to you. And, you know, bring out the best in you. And I just remember looking at Loke, and I could tell in his face, like, he looked at me and he's like, do you know what I would do if they were telling me I was going home on Tuesday? I wouldn't be worried about any of this. And I could really tell, like, man, that's all he wanted. He wanted to hear that, to, hey, you're going home, and really how grateful I should be and where my mentality should be. It shouldn't be playing prison soccer. That shouldn't be on my priority list right now. And it was, you know, an older
older role model, like Loke, an older brother that, like, you know, for the whole time at RCI, took me under his wing. And when you have somebody like that with his statue, I was protected. Let's be honest. When I was out on the yard as the youngest white boy out there, but I was hanging out with Loke and his crew, there was different. It was different, for sure.
You know, someone posted something on Facebook, and I had to share it because it was so – I want to read to you what someone had posted on Facebook, and it got shared. God uses people with the worst past to create the best futures. He uses those who are shattered, tattered, and torn to heal other people. I thought that was the most realistic and most energetic saying that I've ever heard, because this is exactly what God does. He uses people with the worst past, those who have overcome, to help others. And that's what you're talking about, Tom, with Lo, that his past was able to help you. Your past was able to help others. And those who are shattered, tattered, and torn are the ones that are used to heal other people. I had to share that one because I had unbelievable.
Yeah, I like that one too. And what I was going to say before I go, though, is, you know, I'm a genuine person, though, but the thing that I've learned in life is that you don't have to know a person for a very long time to actually develop certain feelings with, as far as caring for that person. You know what I mean? Like I said, as soon as I met Tom, we clicked instantly, you know. So with that being said, like I said, it didn't take much time for me to genuinely care about him. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it was nice, you know, like my prison bid, I was just blessed to always be in tune with the powerful people. That's just how prison works. And I know sometimes Loke doesn't like to think of it like that or anything, but, you know, dude's a powerful, he's a powerful person in there. And I was just blessed to know, like, that's how I did my prison bit. Wherever I go, I wanted to be a part of the leaders. I wanted to be a part of the men that had their minds on straight and be a part of that team aspect. Because I knew individually, Leona, if it was up to me and you could, and God Almighty could look me in the eye right now and say, hey, you know, why are you at where you're at in life? Is it all because of you? Or where would you be if Loke was taken out the picture and you were just thrown in segregation for 4 years and then you got released? I can tell you where I would be. And it wouldn't be right here. So, yes, I know I play a role in it, but how much of a role? I play a little bit. I know I have to get up and be me, but, I mean, this is a team effort.
100%. Well, we have about 50 seconds left. I'm going to say one thing. People in society may think that they're the righteous ones, but they don't realize that it's people like yourselves, I think, sometimes that God is using to test them on the outside. So they need to look at the heart, not the crime. And I wish either of you have anything to say before we close, because we have about 50 seconds.
Free Loke. Give them the campaign, Loke. Tell them your information real quick. They know mine already. All right. Well, I don't know if he's there, but his name is Landris. And I'm going to give you his information after I give out mine. Mine is t.dormer89@yahoo.com. And my Instagram is pit, P-I-T-T, 1.345. His name is Landris, Giant, J-I-N-E-S, number 326049, RCI, Wisconsin. Thank you very, very much, Leona. We appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I appreciate you being on with us, Tom. And I just want to thank you once again for all. But I want to... When you have time, if you can either call me or I'll talk to you, because I want to connect you with the new director of media affairs. I think that, you know, you two could work well together as well, and this would be in the organization.
Okay, call me anytime. I'm free later today. Call me anytime. Thank you so much, Leona.
Okay, thank you. And we are going to be closing now. I thank everyone for being on with us, and I hope that sometime you all get a chance to call in and ask questions or make some comments or just to get to meet Tom in person. We thank you, and we wish you well. We're signing off now. Thank you.